Greetings and welcome to the Recombobulation Area. My name is Dan Schaefer. Thank you for joining us. Wisconsin's partisan primary is now less than 50 days away, and in that primary, voters will be making a number of decisions depending on where in the state you live. But the big one for Democrats statewide will be the primary in the race for governor, where now six candidates are vying to be the party's nominee. One of those candidates is here with us today. He is the former president of the Greater Milwaukee Committee, the former president and CEO of Discovery World, and he was the secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Administration during Tony Evers' first term, and now he's running for governor. He is Joel Brennan. Joel, welcome to the Recombobulation Area.
Dan, nice to be with you. You make it sound like I had a hard time keeping a job for the last several years, but nice to be with you.
Good to be with you as well. So you and I met several years ago back when I was a reporter at the Milwaukee Business Journal and you were the CEO at Discovery World. I was doing a little research before we were talking today, and I saw that I wrote a few stories about Discovery World making an $18 million addition to its lakefront campus, and talked with you about that project and a number of other things. How do you reflect on your time at Discovery World?
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention that. I was there last night. There was the Imagine More dinner that the Medical College of Wisconsin has done now, I think for almost a decade, was there. And there were 500 people in the new space that was created just before I left Discovery World. And, you know, like every time I go back there, I have pride. It is in a much better position than when I started there. And it is poised to do things for another generation and trying to ensure that we're creating problem solvers, inspiring people to go into STEM education, but just generally opening minds to people around STEM, but also sustainability. And, you know, the issues that Discovery World was built for back in the 1980s and has had a bunch of different iterations, those issues are more important now than ever. Getting people to be, you know, just understanding that there are challenges around the world that we need people to be problem solvers about, the issues around climate change and water and sustainability and Milwaukee and Wisconsin's place in the Great Lakes and our responsibility, but then our opportunity and obligation around those things. So like every time I go back there, I am pleased about what it is, but I'm also, you know, there are people who I work with who are carrying on that torch and they're doing a great job. So like, I think that's what you want in a career, is to have seen a place through difficult times, gotten it to a little better, and then watching it just continue to take off in the community.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, how many years exactly were you there then?
I was 11 years, and I started in 2007, and, you know, then 2008, the bottom dropped out of the economy. There were, you know, times when we absolutely had trouble making payroll and trying to figure out where we were going. We were saddled with debt from the construction of the project and through a whole bunch of things, you know, probably 1,000 decisions, and maybe 501 of those were the right decisions. And, you know, like we were able to navigate our way, and it was a community project. I think about the people, you know, some of whom are gone, certainly Mike Cudahy, for whom Discovery World wouldn't exist, but Gary Grunow, Joe Bartolotta, you know, people like that who put their heart and soul into this, and some people who are still around and doing it, who are carrying it on the board and the staff level. So like it is something that has become closer to what I think the founders envisioned it to be in Milwaukee, statewide and nationally. And that's a great thing. Like, but that 11 years, the longest stint of my career was spent there. And yeah, you know, like kids grew up there. Before we went on the air, you were talking about your own kids. My kids are now 19 and 20. They went to summer camp there. They, you know, kind of knew their way around, kind of got the lay of the land as kids there, held most of their birthday parties and things. Like that certainly is always going to be part of a hallmark in my career.
Yeah, and 11 years starting in 2007, that's a period of a lot of change that happened in and around Discovery World and throughout Milwaukee. You know, a lot of like the bigger institutions made a lot of big changes in that time, and you were very much a part of that story.
Yeah, hell, this is we live in a community that is ever evolving. You know, there's no time at which anything is standing still. You know, communities, cities, states are living, breathing organisms, and you know, you continue to make investment, and they continue to evolve. And like again, what's going on the lakefront? I still think we haven't hit our entire stride of what we can do on the lakefront in Milwaukee. There's opportunity there, but like, you know, there's lots of people who are still engaged in the public-private discussions that are going to, in the next generation, make that something even better and more than it has been.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about Milwaukee stuff for all morning here, but let's talk about something else, since there's some other things you've been working on lately. So you're running for governor. Your career has intersected with politics a number of different times over the years. You know, like I mentioned, you were Tony Evers' top cabinet official for much of his first term. You managed campaigns for former Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. But now you're running for office, and that's a different experience. Is this your first time running for elected office, running now for governor?
It's not. So I ran for, you may miss this on my resume, but in 2003, I ran in a Democratic primary for state senate in a district that kind of started at UWM and went down to the county line. So it included Bayview, it included the east side of Milwaukee, downtown, but also places like Oak Creek, South Milwaukee, Cudahy, St. Francis. And I lost in a Democratic primary to the late Jeff Plaley. I was running as clearly the progressive in that race. Jeff was very much of a conservative Democrat. And ultimately, he lost to Chris. I think he lost to, who's our Southside senator?
Chris Larson.
Chris Larson. He lost to him, you know, several years later. And I lost by, you know, 700 or 800 votes in a primary that had 20,000 voters in at that time. And so it's not my first time running. What I am trying to do is trying to, you know, replicate what people like maybe Barack Obama and Abraham Lincoln did, lose their first election and never lose again. Like those would be the people who I would like to emulate.
Well, some very humble comparisons you're making for yourself here.
Just trying to keep good company.
There you go. There you go. So, you know, 6 months on the campaign trail running for governor is obviously much different than, you know, a state senate race 20 some years ago. And obviously much different from a number of things you've done in the past. How has that experience been for you these past 6 months? And what is something that you've learned on the campaign trail that has surprised you?
Yeah. You know, the campaign itself has been intellectually stimulating. You know, like yesterday, I'll tell you, I had a conversation with somebody in Green Bay about the arts and, you know, and kind of where the arts are. He sits on the arts board in Wisconsin. Where are we going with that statewide? I moved on to a conversation with somebody who's a venture capitalist. Like, you know, so talking about the arts and venture capital and like, and there's a thousand other issues that we all get exposed to, and lots of which I've had some exposure to in the course of my career working with nonprofits and government or with businesses. So like, you know, I have found it to be a great experience. My challenge has been that I'm not well known in lots of places around the state. When I walk into a room and I believe that there are 50 undecided people there, and there aren't, you know, I don't necessarily, if you're walking into rooms full of Democrats, a lot of them have already decided in this. And, you know, that's just the way it goes. But when I walk into a room, people, you know, they walk away understanding that the experience I have being the secretary of the Department of Administration, helping run the executive branch, is about as close as you can get to, you know, being governor in the state of Wisconsin. They understand that I have had a diverse set of experiences, that I have a vision and a passion for the state. And I think I'm walking away, you know, with a number of those people, more than not, who would say that guy can be governor. And, you know, and I'm going to be thinking very seriously about him, unless I've actually sealed them up as people who are going to be for me. But like, so those experiences have made it great. But, you know, the challenging part about this is it's still, campaigns are all about money. And, you know, it's a dangerous and challenging thing when somebody from the outside can come in and spend limitless amounts of money, as we have set up the opportunity for people to do here. And, you know, if to the extent we can change that, you know, like Montana is a state that is going toward, you know, potentially doing some things to curb the effects of Citizens United, and Hawaii is doing some things. Like, if Wisconsin can follow, I don't know that we always need to follow the likes of Montana, but if there's ways that we can do things that allow for us to make this more about ideas and less just about financial, you know, concerns and money, that'd be good. But like, I chose this path. It didn't choose me. And so, you know, in every experience you have to kind of fill in the valleys and make sure that the peaks don't get you too high. And that's the way I've tried to make sure I've been going around and doing the campaign. But like meeting new people, going around, I was born the 10th of 11 kids. I was born into a big group. I am a social person. My life has been about relationships. That part of it, I have enjoyed every single minute.
That's really interesting. You know, it's such a unique experience to be kind of where you are and, you know, in the position that you are. I mean, most of the folks who are in this Democratic field have been elected to something before or have a little bit more notoriety. What's it been like going from, you know, just really introducing yourself to a lot of people here? And, you know, how have you found people responding to you and your message in different parts of the state?
Well, I mean, to be honest, part of it is that I have a network of people that I have, the relationships I have gained over the course of my career, a lot of them here in southeastern Wisconsin. But when I was the Secretary of Administration, I was spending time during COVID talking to local elected officials in every corner of Wisconsin. And it wasn't around ideological concerns. I didn't ask them if they were a Republican or a Democrat, a conservative or a progressive. It was what's going on the ground. How can we help? Are there ways that the state can be engaged and involved in what you're doing? And, you know, like that allowed me to see very broadly what's going on around the state of Wisconsin. I also, you know, I've been pleased and really honored to have support from people who were some of the biggest supporters of Herb Kohl when he was running, people who have been supporters and who have been a network for Tony Evers and Jim Doyle and, you know, Tammy Baldwin, people who have built the modern day Democratic Party. And that gives me some credibility in audiences. You know, you get to a point in your life, Dan, where you want to be measured by the company you keep. And I have some people who have been in and around Wisconsin making change for the last 30 or 40 years. And that gives me credibility. It only gives me so much. I still have to convince people that, one, I've got the capability of doing the job, and I think that I've demonstrated that. Two, that I've got ideas, maybe different ideas than other people, and that I can win in a general election. And, you know, like, I think I went to an event the other night, and Jessica McBride, who I wouldn't always quote, you know, to you or anybody else, but she was there, and she wrote a little thing about me, and you know, I think part of what she wrote was that, you know, this guy probably, there's almost no way that Tom Tiffany would beat this guy if the Democrats, you know, put him into the general election. Like that's an arch conservative who's saying these things. And I think that there's lots of people around who are seeing and believing that I can absolutely win a general election. I got to win a Democratic primary first. And so all of this is an effort to try to make sure that I am getting people to understand the progressive values I have, the plans that I have, and what I've demonstrated I can do in terms of problem solving.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about, you mentioned the, you know, you've got the executive, you know, the experience that piece that you've talked about. And then you mentioned the ideas that you feel separate you from the rest of the field. You know, there's obviously been so many candidate forums over the past few months, you know, watching these, there's a lot that candidates agree on, you know, they're Democrats after all. But what are some of those ideas that you feel separates you from the rest of the field and makes your campaign unique?
Well, just a couple. And these are things that I have suggested through the course of the campaign that Tony Evers could be doing now. You know, we have challenges around ICE. We have saw what happened in Minneapolis and in Chicago and in other parts of the country. And it just beneath us. And, you know, what a few other states have done is to set up an accountability commission for ICE that's got 7 or 9 people on it, people who are, you know, the extent of which are the likes of whom are retired Supreme Court justices, retired law enforcement, people who have worked in immigration nonprofits. Like the state of Illinois set up one of these. It's also a place where if there's ICE activity in your community and you're videotaping it or you're taking pictures, you can upload that to a state sanctioned, state protected website so that ultimately when we can hold people to account, whether they're wearing a federal uniform, if they're breaking state law, you know, there's going to come a time when we can hold those people to account. I think we should be doing that now. And I you know, laid that out months ago. And I think Governor Evers should, you know, it'd be wise for us to be in a position to be ready to go with something like that. You know, so like that's when it comes to ICE. I've also, you know, when we need to be protecting elections here, you know, I've also suggested, and the governor may be making plans to do this, but When it comes to election protection, making sure you protect the early voting, yes, and the vote by mail and the bipartisan reforms. But I've also suggested, and I think I'm the only candidate who has, that we should be prepared to bring up the National Guard members for our elections this fall, not in uniform, not, you know, with their guns and bayonets, as Steve Bannon wants ICE to be, you know, out there. These are people, 10,000 of them, who are our friends and our neighbors in the community. In 2020, when we had challenges around COVID, the governor called up the National Guard members, and they worked right alongside their community members. We should be prepared to do that in Wisconsin here. We should exhaust every other opportunity to get people, you know, working on the campaigns. I got, I've worked on election day in the past. I got maybe you have too. I got an email the other day from the city of Milwaukee saying, hey, it's time for you to start. I'm going to be busy on this particular day, you know, so I'm not going to be able to do that. But if there is a need, and if they're not getting who they need, we need to make sure that we have every, you know, polling place covered. We need to make sure that we are not lacking in personnel. Like, those are the kind of things that we could do on a very specific issue. You know, again, I don't know. I know you live on the west side. I don't know whether you're a homeowner or a renter. You know, you've got a young family, but you're in a position where, you know, like, you are like lots of other people. The average age for a first-time home buyer in Wisconsin and nationally is now 40 years old. You know, like, my kids are 20. I don't want to have them wait another 20 years to do that. And that's something that's kind of tearing away at the fabric of Wisconsin. So I've proposed that, you know, in this stuck marketplace, we build 100,000 new entry-level homes in Wisconsin, but that we also explore through WEDA a 3% state-backed mortgage, where, you know, for young families, young people trying to get that first house, they would qualify potentially for a 3% mortgage, but also for baby boomers, because there are lots of places. I went to Eau Claire. 25% of the people in Eau Claire who own a home are individuals. They're living there by themselves. And lots of these baby boomers are sitting on 3 and 4 bedrooms, but if they downsize, they've been moving from a 3% mortgage to a 7% mortgage. That, you know, like, so you can qualify for a 3% mortgage if you're a first-time home buyer. You can qualify if you're a baby boomer and you meet the qualifications. Like, I think those are pragmatic, solution-oriented ideas, and I think that's what people want. Like, and that's who I have tried to demonstrate myself to be throughout my career, is somebody who, yes, I've got my progressive Wisconsin values, but I'm willing to work with businesses. I'm willing to work with in the nonprofit sector. Government should be about solutions rather than about, you know, grievance and vengeance, which we have seen way too much of, and which has poisoned the well for so many people.
In what sense?
People are not participating. People are giving up. You know, people are, you know, they think that what we need to do in state government is just, you know, grind somebody into submission who's on the other side. Like, you know, Tony Evers' great gift to Wisconsin, one of them, is that he's leaving us with a legislature that looks very much like our state. You know, I expect and I plan that the Democrats are going to have a majority in the state Senate, majority in the state assembly, and I will be governor come January. But that means, you know, even with that, we're going to have a 1 or 2 seat majority in either direction. These are muscles we have not exercised for the last 15 years. When Scott Walker got elected in 2010, most consequential statewide election of my lifetime, in my opinion, you know, they won the majority in the assembly. They won the majority in the Senate. They gerrymandered the maps we've been living with for the last 16 years. This is the first time that we're, you know, finally out from under those maps. They passed Act 10. They, you know, gutted places like the Department of Natural Resources. And we have lived in a Wisconsin that's hard to recognize for the last 15 years. We now have an opportunity to do something differently. But if there's a 1 or 2 seat majority, it can't just be, you know, that we're going to grind the other side into submission. We better be able to find and demonstrate how we're actually getting stuff done, or it's going to be a very short time in the majority for the Democrats. The Republicans, you know, potentially would win back the legislature shortly. We've got a presidential election that's going to be hugely consequential in 2 years. Like, you know, we can't go back to having 2030 be a repeat of 2010, where, you know, they win, they gerrymander the maps, and by the time I'm 75, you know, maybe we've got another chance to do something. I want to make sure, like, again, I'm going to be 70 years old in 2040. What I'd like to do is look back in 2040 and say, hey, we closed the book on Scott Walker and all that damage that had been done starting in 2010 when we had those elections in 2026. And we ushered in a 15-year period of the Wisconsin that we knew, where we were a leader, where we were progressive, where we were, you know, instead of playing defense, we were able to go on the offensive on issues. Like that's what I think we have the opportunity to do now.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think you touched on it a little bit there, but, you know, it's with any new administration, there's always this balance to seek between how much of the prior administration, you know, especially if it's of a different party, would you want to clean up or change or whatever it might be, versus kind of, you know, maybe, like you said, kind of more playing some offense and trying to get some things done. You know, it's a little bit different in Wisconsin here because it's not like we're coming right after Walker. You know, Tony Evers has been governor for 8 years, but we've also had, like you said, a heavily gerrymandered Republican controlled state legislature for that time. So how would you balance that with trying to, you know, address past issues with, you know, advancing, you know, a more playing offense type of agenda?
Yeah, well, one, I was there in the first days of the Evers administration. Like, we had to clean up that mess that Scott Walker had made. And, you know, you had all kinds of ways in which they had kicked the can down the road and, you know, and they had borrowed where, you know, to protect Scott Walker's political future instead of protect the interests of the state of Wisconsin. So we did a whole bunch of stuff there. We created the rainy day fund that was like $170 million when we arrived and grew it to almost $2 billion. Created the largest surplus at that point in state history. We dealt with COVID, which was, you know, from an economic standpoint, in some ways, the most challenging thing we had in 100 years. Like, I have lived through all that, and I've demonstrated through that's the way I think we should lead in times of crisis, but also in what passes for normal times. You know, and people ask all the time, what would you do differently than Tony Evers? I'm telling you, the difference is the environment and the context. The difference is, you know, that, yes, you know, he introduced Medicaid Badger Care expansion in every budget that he did. He introduced, you know, initially medical marijuana and then recreational as well. Like, those are things that immediately got taken out. There are other things that, you know, we have opportunity to do around the K-12 funding formula that people haven't thought about in a generation. Like, that's the way that we go on the offensive. We do things that actually demonstrate to people that we're listening, that we're going to be able to deal with some of the challenges they're having at their kitchen table, you know, when they're deciding between paying rent or paying for their prescription drugs or, you know, the mortgage payment and their utility bill. Like, those are things, you know, again, and I say this as a Democrat, been a Democrat all my life. It's unfortunate to us. People don't trust government, People trust Democrats less than they trust Republicans. I'm not sure it's warranted. I don't know why it comes that way, but there is a belief that when we get in power, we don't do things that are responsive to what people's needs are. And so I think we better be able to do that. And I've demonstrated that throughout my career already. But the environment is so materially different than the one that Tony Evers walked into that, you know, I think that's going to be the huge difference for the next governor. And I was there for the first one, and I put together two budgets with him for that. I will be the person putting together the next budget, you know, but the legislature is not going to take it, look at it, throw it in the trash, and then go do whatever the hell they want, which is what happened over the course of the, you know, the first 6 years of the Evers administration. They finally had to, you know, bring some people to the table when the fair maps created an opportunity for us to at least have a chance there. But that's going to be the norm, at least for the next 4 years here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of change coming in Wisconsin state government, right? I mean, obviously, Tony Evers is retiring, but also longtime Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who was really the dominant figure for the Republican-controlled legislature for about 15 years. I mean, how do you assess, you know, what are some of the ways that you dealt with the Republican-controlled legislature and Robin Voss in particular? And how do you assess the landscape of what the legislature might look like with him gone?
Well, so start with this. Like, I'm more focused on the Democrats than the Republicans. But do you know that there are 45 Democrats in the Assembly right now? 23 of those were elected for the first time 2 years ago. So, you know, more than half of the Democrats are running for election for the first time. I don't know the stats on the Republican side, but I think it's, you know, not dissimilar. And there are so many who are leaving now. You're going to have a whole new crop coming in this fall. So, you know, like more than half of the legislature, my guess is, hasn't been around in the last, you know, longer than the last 4 years here. And that's an opportunity for us. It's an opportunity for advocates to make sure that, you know, these things that for 15 years, yes, it was, what does Robin think about this? Are we going to do it or not? Like that was, you know, he was the decider on those things. And I think this is where public policy gets done. I've been doing it for 35 years. And when you've got opportunities to have a different set of allies on issue X than on issue Y, if you can make a strong argument, if you have a strong executive branch, there is going to be some feeling out in the legislative branch. But I think, you know, for a long time, there's been kind of this imbalance where the Republicans in the assembly and the legislature had, in some ways, they tried to push the upper hand against the executive branch. Government works best when there is a strong executive, a strong judiciary, and a strong legislative branch. Like, I think we're entering into a time where we can do that. You asked, you know, how have I worked with legislators in the past? I've tried to do it by relationship. You know, like if Robin Voss wanted to call me right now, he's got my cell number. And, you know, and we shared that from the first days that I was working in the Evers administration. And I probably have a dozen, you know, Republican elected officials who have that number too. And I'm not going to change that when I become governor. I'm going to have access to people on both sides of the aisle. I'm going to use the office and use, I think, even the residents and things like that, because relationships have to matter in this. And, you know, I'm somebody who's built my whole life on relationships more so than, you know, believing that I had some exquisite talent that I had that's beyond anybody else. I work hard on relationships. And I think that's something that governors have to do in order to get the most out of the job.
Mm-hmm. So you've obviously had a lot of experience being a leader at large organizations. So I think that part of your resume doesn't come with as much confusion or uncertainty. But what I'm interested to know more about is what you would want to do as governor. So first 100 days, what would a Joel Brennan administration look like? And what would you seek to prioritize in your first budget?
Well, the first 100 days is putting together the budget. I'll tell you, it was amazing to me. And this is some the great admiration I have for people who work in state government. The state budget office, up until November of 2018, they were working on a Scott Walker budget to be introduced at the beginning of 2019. Tony Evers wins. They then are working on a Tony Evers budget. Like public servants sometimes get a raw deal and a bad name. Like those are people lay their ideology at the door and that's what they do. And so, you know, I would be inheriting what has been a Tony Evers budget. But I think that the most important things we do that we have to do are ensure that we are doing things that relate to what people are feeling related to affordability. So, you know, even though it doesn't have as much value as it would have had Scott Walker done it 12 years ago, and we would have another $2.5 billion to push towards the affordability challenges, we need to expand Badger Care and Medicaid in Wisconsin. We need to have a budget, you know, some of the things that Tony Evers has tried to do, a budget that would provide for opportunity for us to legalize marijuana and tax it, ensure that, you know, we are doing things around prescription drugs. You know, there are pharmacies that have been closing around the state, not because they don't have enough customers, but because pharmacy benefit managers are squeezing things so much in the system between the drug manufacturers and the consumers that it doesn't pay for pharmacies to stay open. So like those are the types of things immediately on healthcare that we have to do. You know, I would make sure, I don't know that we can get it done in the first 100 days, but we absolutely need to make sure that we are focused on the K-12 education funding formula. That's probably, you know, something for the entirety of the first term. But when you are pitting property taxpayers against kids all around the state of Wisconsin, you know, in April, 60 school districts went to referendum for operations to keep the lights on, not to build something new, but to just do the basics. Like that's Wisconsin failing when it comes to providing for education. And we see it in some of the outcomes as well. Like, so those are the things that we've got to do initially and immediately, but also there's a change of tone. Like, again, I am somebody who I am not going to try to do this just around wreaking vengeance on the other side. I am not there to even the score. Wisconsin's motto is still forward, and we need to make sure that we are doing things that get us there. Like those are the types of things we can do. And I'll tell you what needs to happen in the first 100 days as well whether it's through the budget or not, but some the ability to add some certainty to data centers is something that we deserve and we need as a state. The state government hung local officials out to dry when they passed that the tax policy in the budget a few years ago, and they put no guardrails on it all. So guardrails that ensure you and I aren't going to pay for any of the AI for the construction, the operation, the long-term maintenance, the ultimate retirement of the data centers, make sure Wisconsin labor, you know, Wisconsin workers are doing it, meet all the environmental standards, and ensure that local units of government and local individuals have a say in what happens in data centers, that there's never any non-disclosure agreements anymore. Like, and I have said, you know, I don't need to do it for a year. I don't need to talk about a moratorium, but if we need to pause, and I would pause approval of new data centers. And I think you can do that in the first 2 months of the legislature. Like, that level of certainty is, I think, what people want, not arbitrary deadlines of, yeah, we're going to do it for this long. Like, make certain that people know that this is one of the huge priorities, because everywhere you go around the state of Wisconsin, people are talking about it. And we're forcing local governments to kind of have to do this in lieu of state action. And that, you know, you need to have the right kind of relationship between state and local government if you're going to get things done.
But so do you think that?
Let me just say this, though. I mean, it's worthwhile for you to ask about the first 100 days and the first 30 days. But I've already said it. Like, this is a generational opportunity for us to look back 15 years from now and say, we did something in 2026 that made it different for Wisconsin for a generation. We have already had a generation that's been scarred by what happened starting in 2010. You know, like, we need to be in a position where we're building things up so that we win a presidential election in 28, we win in 2030, and we ensure that there are fair maps moving forward. Like, those are the types of things we can do that are an opportunity for us now that we haven't had in the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly on the data centers too, though. So do you think the state needs to be more proactive about setting statewide standards? I know there was, yes, you know, Democrat Jody Habersynnikin introduced a bill in the state Senate this past session. You know, I think there's been a lot of talk also about, you know, setting a moratorium on data center development. I mean, how do you navigate, you know, where you stand on that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been pretty clear on where I stand. I mean, not only, and I talked to Jody about her bill, and Angela Stroud, who represents the far northwest part of the state, who was one of the leads in the assembly. And they went through, I think, 12 drafts of that bill, and it had involvement and engagement from union stakeholders, from, you know, businesses, utilities, environmental groups. And there's a lot to build on right there. And so, you know, and that bill never saw the light of day for the most part under a Republican legislature. Like, that should be where we start. And that's why I don't think that we need to say, you know, for the next year, we do nothing. I just don't think that's the way that government should work, like setting some sort of an arbitrary deadline. I've been very clear and said that we would pause any approval of new data centers. Doesn't mean that the people in Wisconsin who are working on the ones that are under construction, we're not going to pull them off the job. We're not going to make sure that this goes on forever. But you have a bill that's sitting there that is the core of, I think, where we need to go. That, you know, statewide certainty is what I think everybody is looking for. And I think that will lay the groundwork for what we can and should be doing at the local level. It's not going to make everybody happy. Like, that's not what government's about. It's about, government is about certainty. Government is about making sure that people know kind of what the benchmarks are, what's the bar that I need to hit to do that. There are going to be communities that approve data centers, and, you know, and there already have been. But if they do it under a set of circumstances where everybody knows the rules, like, that's going to be good for Wisconsin. You know, in DeForest, in Caledonia, they said, no, we're not going to do this. There have been Greenleaf, you know, when there was even a sniff of it, it already was undone. And that's fine, as long as it's a transparent process that everybody understands. There are other places that are going to, you know, go through the process, and they're going to build these things.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. It's obviously a huge issue. Another huge issue that you touched on earlier in your campaign released a set of proposals on, I think is a really important one, the issue of housing and home ownership.
Yeah.
Like I said, you talked about this a little bit earlier, but could you break down those proposals and tell us why you're making that a priority?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'll tell you why I'm making it a priority. in 1990, when I was 20 years old, average age for a first-time home buyer was 28. In 2020, it was 33. Last year, it was 40. You know, we're taking a generation and we're telling them that home ownership, this American dream, is not for you. Like, you know, I'll tell you, I didn't make a big deal out of it, but on my birthday, about 3 weeks ago, my wife and I paid off the last installment of our mortgage. We've lived in our house for 21 years. Like, that is a day, it's likely the only day, maybe the only day like that in our lifetimes. Like, this is, you know, and what that means for my kids and our future, and, you know, what it also means for our neighborhood, because we've been stakeholders in our neighborhood over the last 20 years. Like, that's the same thing is repeated everywhere around the state. And there are way too many people who just, they don't have an opportunity to do that. They're waiting 7 years to get the down, you know, to save up for the down payment on a house, or in their community, the new houses that are being built are $500,000. That's not an entry level house. And so, you know, what I have laid out, and this goes back to my days working in state government at DOA and going and visiting businesses around the state, you know, 100,000 new entry-level homes, that means $300,000, $350,000. And if we're in a position where it costs you $300,000 to build and a family can pay $250,000, how can the state be part of that delta? That's the difference between that. Ultimately, that's going to pay off for the state if you get more home ownership, if you get people able to locate in communities around the state. And, you know, the states of Michigan, Ohio, we all have deficits when it comes to the number of new homes that we need. They have done a better job in Wisconsin over the last 5 years than we have. We've actually been losing ground. And, you know, like, I don't want to lose ground to Michigan. I don't want to lose to Michigan in anything, not in sports, not in, you know, in anything we're doing. And so we need to be focused on winning. We're still Wisconsin, where we build stuff. So planting a flag and saying, this is what we're going to do, like, that's part of what who we have to be. I already mentioned the, you know, the WIDA 3% mortgage, because we've also got a stuck marketplace where, you know, there are baby boomers who have been in their homes for a long time. If they moved into a condo, if they downsize, they're going from paying no mortgage or paying a 3% mortgage like we had to a 7% mortgage right now. So if they qualify, you know, and they can get out and move somewhere else, it opens it up for a young family to do that. There are other things that, you know, the homestead credit, which hasn't been updated in like 30 years, that allows for people to stay in their homes. Like, those are the types of things. There are tools that we have that are around home ownership and around making sure that we can, you know, create communities. And I think they need either updating or they need some supercharging. The last thing on that, and not everybody's going to own their own home. Like, you know, a lot of people still rent, but here in Milwaukee, you've seen it, and it happens elsewhere, where Wall Street is buying up properties, multifamily, and, you know, people, the rents are being jacked up in ways that people have no chance of ever getting to the point of making that down payment on a house. Or, you know, they're paying more in their rent than they would in a mortgage, but they can't find a way to get through to that. I was in Sheboygan over the weekend. I was talking to a woman who owns a mobile home. And she's lived there for the last couple of years. The owner of the underlying property is in Florida. They've increased her rent. They've doubled it in the last 2 years. Do you think she's getting a hell of a lot more out of that property than she was 2 years ago? It's of no value to her, except that she can plug in and be there with her mobile home. And she's living on a fixed income. She's retired. Like, this is the kind of stuff that's pushing people away. And so, you know, we need to make sure that where we can, we are ensuring that Wisconsin, the rights of Wisconsin renters and homeowners are protected from some of that stuff that's going on by these entities that are far from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. And how much of it is, you know, just a supply and demand issue too? You mentioned in your proposal, you wanted to build 100,000 entry-level homes. I think Amy Klobuchar, running for governor in Minnesota, mentioned something similar as well. How much of this issue is, you know, the fact that maybe we haven't built enough housing over the past 15 years?
It is absolutely the case. And, you know, and I'm thrilled that Amy Klobuchar is stealing my ideas, you know, but like, I looked at what they did in Michigan, you know, I mean, so if you want to say, maybe I stole this from Gretchen Whitmer, like, she,
it's moving across the upper Midwest here. Yeah.
And again, I already told you, like, there is data around this. There is a deficit of housing in almost every one of the upper Midwest states. And there are places, Ohio, Michigan, they have brought that deficit down over the last several years as ours continues to go up. So absolutely, it's a case of underproduction. And we're producing homes. You know, again, there are communities around here, and I don't begrudge them, but they're building lots of new single family homes for $500,000. That is not an entry level home. And, you know, this is kind of some of that missing middle, or the way that we attack and address what everybody needs. And it is not just a question about, you know, home ownership and what that means for equity and like, but this is around K-12 education. It's around what employers need. Like, these are the types of things that we can do it. And, you know, like, I think you get something by planting a flag and saying, this is what we're going to do. We're going to relentlessly measure it. We're going to say, here's how we're doing. In Wisconsin, you know, I think over the last, I'm proposing 100,000 new entry-level homes over the next 4 years. I think we've struggled to get to 50,000 in the last 4 years. And, you know, so that's at least a doubling. I talked to some people in the housing industry who are a little suspect that we've even been doing that, you know, 12,000 a year or whatever. But like, I think if we plant that flag and we have the right partnership between state and local government, like, these are the types of things where you set your mind to it, you put resources behind it, and you stand up and you say, we're going to do it. Like, you know, again, I hate to invoke Scott Walker, except to say that we helped clean up lots of his messes, but he wanted to, you know, he said he was going to create 250,000 jobs. If there's one thing people remembered from his campaign, it was that. He failed miserably, you know, but like, at least setting that marker and doing it, you know, I think he probably started running away from that later on in his term. I'm not going to run away from the fact that this is what we're going to do, and this is who we have to be, like, and I want to be measured on that.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the presumptive Republican nominee, Congressman Tom Tiffany. How do you assess Tiffany as a congressman, as a candidate, and how do you feel you would match up with against him if you were to become the nominee?
Well, just one thing about it, he and I were both at the Sheboygan Dairy Breakfast on Saturday. You know, they were almost back to back. I was serving out the sausages. He was serving out the ham. You know, I said to some people, one of us might be slinging some bull, or has in the course of our career, you know, but like, I have nothing against Tom personally. I know him, and when I saw him there and I saw him at the Dane County Dairy Breakfast, we were cordial. You know, this is not for me about blood sport. It's about difference of opinion, difference of background. You know, like, I don't know that Tom has done much since he's been in Congress except defend what Donald Trump has done. And he's going to have to live with that. And he's going to answer to that. You know, he now is, again, I think he's running commercials that try to make him feel very human and humane and have members of his family. I am doing the same thing. I want people to know that. But for me, I also want people to know about what my career has been around accomplishment, around making sure that it's about problem solving. You know, Tom Tiffany is in the midst of the course of his career. I think one of the first votes he ever took was to decertify elections that that happened in 2020. He's done things, you know, that are going to kick people off of Medicaid, taking out $800 billion of Medicaid spending over the next 10 years. In the next year, they're trying to kick 6 million people off of SNAP and food share benefits, including 1 million kids. He's going to have to answer to those things. He is, you know, someone who is in the shadow of the Trump tree, and he's going to have to answer to that. And I expect he will have to answer to that. You know, but I've also got to make sure that this is an election that's not just about being against what Donald Trump or Tom Tiffany stand for. I will proudly, absolutely stand against those, and he's going to have to live with the decisions he has made. But I also think, and this goes back to what we were just talking about, we've got to demonstrate, one, that we're listening to people, two, that we're going to be responsive, that we're going to talk about issues around how do people get access to better health care? How do we improve the outcomes in our public schools around the state? How do we give people an avenue for, you know, that slice of the American dream, that's home ownership? Like, those are the things we still have to do. There are direct, obvious contrasts that I'm going to be able to make with Tom, you know, but I got to make sure that I am doing this in a way that promotes that there is a path forward for Wisconsin, and that we're going to be talking and dealing with the issues that people are caring about at their kitchen table.
All right. One last thing for you, Joel. I know you're a Milwaukeean. I know you're a basketball fan. We just got some big news with Giannis Antetokounmpo this week. How are you feeling about it? I'm a little discombobulated myself.
Yeah, I know. I know there are lots of us who are fans. Like, again, remember, I was born in 1970. The Bucks won the championship in 1971. I didn't get to see the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar era, but that means I have lived through some ups and downs of the Bucks over the last, over the course of my lifetime, always being a fan.
Lots of downs, but yes, Sidney lots Moncrief. Of ups too. Yeah.
You know, if there was a person when I was a kid growing up, I wanted to be like, it was Sidney Moncrief, who, both as a basketball player and ultimately as a person, as he has demonstrated too. So like,
absolutely.
Sure, these are challenging times. And I wrote something, a little something yesterday too, probably not to the depths that you did, but like, we got to all watch. We were blessed to watch this 19-year-old kid, grow into somebody who is such a, like, put the community on his shoulders, and those big, broad shoulders. And we got to, live in the shadow of that and watch that. And that was unbelievable. The fact of what they did for Milwaukee and what they did for Wisconsin, like, he elevated us, even elevated what we think about ourselves and what opportunities we have. There are going to be, we drafted two guys last night who are going to be part of the next generation. And there will be good times again that come to Milwaukee, probably because he has demonstrated that that's who we can be. And I'd like to think that that's who we should be. But, but by the same token, my son is now 19. He's grown up watching Giannis and watching the Bucks be as good as anybody else in the NBA throughout most of his life. There is absolutely a sense of disappointment and the energy and the enthusiasm that we've had around the Bucks. Like, but here's something I'll tell you. I was at an event last night, and part of it was like one of the auction items was like Bucks tickets for next season. There was an excitement around the room. Yeah, they may be young. They may be back to being mistake prone, but people are going to want to go watch it, and they're going to watch this grow. Like, this is the case of sports at the at the professional level. So I'm excited about what comes next, but I am absolutely and eternally grateful for having been here and having had the opportunity to have sometimes a front row seat, sometimes a seat on my couch or up in the rafters to watch what Giannis has become and what he meant to the NBA in Milwaukee. Does that make you feel any better?
A little better. I'm a little bit more recombobulated, some fresh hope with the draft. We've got, we got a new coach. Like, I'm still a Bucks fan. I'm still going to be watching every game with my kids and all of that too. So,
and we've got, we're poised to have playoff baseball again.
That's right.
You need to do this. I think somebody told me recently, we have finished ahead of the Cubs 8 consecutive years. And, once again, they're looking up to us significantly in the standings. Today, on days like we had this week, somebody said it feels like October, instead of June, but we may be playing baseball again in October. And we are absolutely blessed there. So, and Packer season is coming. My God, there's still plenty of sports for us to talk. We could have another conversation just around sports.
I would love that. That sounds great. Well, Joel, thank you so much for taking some time. You've been very generous with your time this morning, and looking forward to seeing what you and your campaign have in store over these next few weeks before the August 11th primary.
Appreciate your time. Thanks a lot, Dan.